This is the Equip Podcast from Cornerstone Church of Ames, a podcast designed to help you live a gospel-fueled and faithful life wherever Jesus has called you.
Hello again. Welcome to the Equip Podcast from Cornerstone Church. My name's Mark Vance. Glad to be with you all today. And I'm actually going to be recording not just one, but two podcasts here over the next couple weeks that we're going to release that are all tackling the question of what it means to work for pro-life causes, or what it means to be against abortion as a Christian. Why is it that we defend the rights of the preborn? And why is it that biblically and morally we work toward that? And I also want to explore just some practical ways that you can get involved as a person in standing up to speak for those who don't have a voice for themselves, and in using your voice to lift up the rights to life for the preborn people in our world. And I'm going to kind of examine this from two major angles. The first one, and this is going to be podcast one, is I want to take just a bit of time to give you a refresher, or maybe a first introduction, to the biblical and moral argument for a pro-life position. Why unborn, preborn human beings have a right to life. But then the second podcast that we're going to record, kind of part two of this, I want to actually examine some of the political, social, and practical ways that Christians can get involved to work to end the practice of abortion legally, but perhaps even more importantly, to lower the number of abortions systemically across the board in our communities and in our country. Now, why does this come to the forefront? Well, I want to give three reasons for this before we dive into the biblical and moral arguments for why this matters right now. The first one has to do with our contemporary situation. I've gotten some notes from a number of you who've noticed that if you look at the news headlines, abortion is making the headlines in part because of the new Texas law, which is a unique and ingenious legal maneuver that involves a heartbeat law combined with people who can bring a civil suit against those who would practice abortion. I have to be honest to say, I don't believe that that law is going to stand up very long. It's a very unique sort of legal framework. The more important legal case actually underneath that Texas case is one that in recent days the Supreme Court announced they will hear arguments for, it's called the Dobbs case. It has to do with a Mississippi law. And many conservative legal scholars believe there's a significant chance that the Roe-Casey framework, or Roe v. Wade, will be either overturned or significantly rewritten by the Supreme Court as a result of the Dobbs case. So you can expect to hear more and more politically. That's part of the reason we address that, is you're going to hear about it. The second reason that we address that is just as a personal passion. For me, as a person, you might not know this about my family. Both my younger brothers are adopted and were adopted out of crisis situations. My family was a foster family growing up, and a number of times in the life of my childhood, we were the family that had the privilege of caring for a young baby who was born, whose birth mother had given that baby up for adoption, and taken that courageous choice, and we would kind of be the foster family that would go from birth mom to the adoptive parents. And that was an incredible privilege for us as a family. And then later in life, my wife, for a period of several years, worked as part of a crisis pregnancy center ministry in the Des Moines area, trying to help young moms who found themselves unexpectedly pregnant to both keep the baby or help them to get to a place where they could see that baby adopted into a wonderful family. And they helped to support people in that process with training and coaching and sharing the good news of Jesus with them. And so it's a personal issue to me. It's something that throughout my childhood and adult life has been an area where I care deeply. But I think the third reason is, whether you know it or not, abortion is perhaps the most pressing justice issue in the world today. If you were to look, let's go 2018, at worldwide cause of death, abortion is the number one cause of death worldwide in 2018. In 2018, worldwide, 42 million human beings were killed through the practice of abortion. That amounts to 7 Holocausts happening every year. If you look across the world today, look at children who are diagnosed with a condition like Down syndrome in the womb. You could go to many European countries and 100% of those pregnancies are being terminated right now. In the worldwide, a child who is diagnosed with Down syndrome in the world now stands a 90% of chance of their life being terminated before they have the chance to take a breath. There is tremendous injustice happening here. And so as God's people who are called to stand up and to speak for those who have no voice, there is perhaps no more pressing moral issue in the world of justice today than to stand up and speak for the rights of the unborn. Now, as I go through this, I'm going to give you two sources where I'm drawing a lot of information from that have been really helpful. I think it would do you good to dig further into them. The first is a blog. If you search Justin Taylor and his blog, Between Two Worlds, it's hosted by the Gospel Coalition. Justin consistently, over the last 10 years, has written about the question of abortion from a Christian angle, and his resources that he's compiled are simply the best that I can find online in one place from a Christian perspective. The second source that I'm going to look at some is actually an appendix to the book Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth by Thaddeus Williams. He has some really, really good information in there. And he kind of comes from a stream. Another name I'd like you to kind of be aware of is the name Greg Kokel. His ministry, Stand to Reason, that's an apologetic and Christian worldview ministry. The material they put out on abortion is and the right to life is really, really good from a Christian perspective. So those three, Justin Taylor, Thaddeus Williams, Greg Kokel, those three are kind of the guys guiding me in this discussion. So podcast one, we're going to take 10, 15 minutes to talk about the biblical and moral grounding for being pro-life or fighting for the lives of the pre-born human beings. Now, where do we come from and why? So as Christians, this has to do with our belief about what human beings are. Genesis 1 tells us that when God creates man, he creates man and woman in his image. In a unique way, that means that human beings are the only of all of the creatures that God made that possess this unique and distinctive image-bearing quality. And that being made in the image of God means we have intrinsic worth and value in humans, such that every human being has a right to life. Genesis 9, after the flood of Noah, kind of makes this right to life very explicit in the text, where there's a command to Noah, no one can take another human life, and if they do, their life should be given in retribution and retributive justice. That's reiterated in the Ten Commandments with the simple statement, Exodus 20, verse 13. The command says, do not murder. You cannot take another human life. And particularly when it comes to the rights of the preborn, I think the clearest text to articulate this is found in Psalm 139. Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16, read, "It was you who created my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I will praise you because I have been remarkably and wondrously made. Your works are wondrous. I know this very well. My bones were not hidden from you when I was made in secret. When I was formed in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw me when I was formless. All of my days were written in your book and planned before a single one of them began." David, writing about God's care and provision of him, says, "God, I was your creation, made in your image from before I was born." That means even though David doesn't have a voice when he's created in his mother's womb, he has personhood in his mother's womb. So as Christians, we've largely summarized it this way. A human life begins at conception, not simply at birth. In the womb, the individual, therefore, is a human with the right to life. And that should not be taken from them. And in particular, that human being in the womb is the most vulnerable of all human beings. And so therefore, in our call to work for mercy, justice, and compassion for people made in God's image, of all the people in the world who deserve compassion, it would be even more so incumbent on us as Christians to stand up for those who literally cannot stand up for themselves. James 1:27 says this, "Pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Pure religion looks like using the power and influence you have to look after those who can't look after themselves, who are the most vulnerable. And so as Christians, there is a biblically compelling case to work for the right to life. Now, philosophically, let's kind of build on that. If I were to state this out, kind of this moral argument philosophically, I'd state it this way. Kind of there's four steps to it. And this is kind of the commonplace argument in pro-life circles. So it says, step one, it is wrong to take the life of a human person because all human persons, all humans made in God's image have the right to life. That's step one. Step two, preborn persons are humans with a right to life. Step three, abortion takes the life of a preborn person. Step four, therefore abortion is wrong. So I'm just going to go those over again. Step one, it's wrong to take the life of a human person. All humans have a right to life. Step two, preborn persons are humans with a right to life. Step three, abortion takes the life of a preborn person. Therefore, step four, abortion is wrong. The key in that kind of four-step argument, really the key questions revolve around step two. Preborn persons are human people with a right to life. Some would say, well, I don't know that that's particularly true, because where does a preborn person become really a fully right-to-life-owning human person? The key question in the public discussion here is, when does the right to life kick in for a person? I don't know people, conservative or liberal, who believe that no one has a right to life. The question is, when does that right to life kick in? And there's four main arguments there, maybe five, I think. I'm going to state them quickly. That right to life begins at conception, that right to life begins connected to pain, that the right to life begins, thirdly, connected to viability, fourthly, that the right to life can begin at connected to location, and then the fifth actually has to do with kind of an individualism argument. So I'm going to go through those five. When does a person have a right to life? Well, the first argument, the one I would hold to, is that right to life begins at conception. Here I'm going to quote from Justin Taylor. He says, the human embryo is a whole, albeit immature, living member of the species of Homo sapiens. It is the same kind of entity as you or I at a different and earlier stage of development. A human embryo is not simply a piece of the mother's body. They have an entirely different DNA structure. They're a different entire entity. All they are immature in their development, they're the same member of the living species of human being that you and I are. Therefore, their right to life begins at their conception. Okay? That's argument one. Argument two, some would say, right to life begins connected to when they can feel pain. This argument is often connected to what people would call brain function. They would say, and this, it's hard for us to totally estimate, but estimates come in between 6 to 14 weeks. I tend to think the earlier is the better estimate here, that says the right to life kicks in when people really feel pain. And I honestly think this is not an argument from logic, but an argument from empathy. We don't want people to feel bad when we kill them, to put it grotesquely. The third argument, it has to do with viability. Most people say, well, a person has a right to life when they could live on their own outside the womb. And so if a baby could survive, then maybe that's, well, some would put that, most put that 24 to 26 weeks. I'm just going to simply point this out. We have a champion in our church named Zeke Veer, who was born at 23 weeks old, and who is going to, Lord willing, be coming home from the hospital soon. So even our notions of when is a baby viable to ultimately live are shifting at this moment, and I would love in the future to introduce you to Zeke. Okay, fourth, that location really has to do with when right to life kicks in. By this, what I mean is, the question is, where is the baby? If the baby's inside the mother's womb, well, that's the mother's problem. But as soon as they exit the mother's womb, they now have a different location, therefore a different right to life. That would be the argument of some. So you could see the person's right to life changing in the span of 5 seconds as they go out from the mother into the world and now suddenly own a right to life. That's the location argument. The final one is individualism, which really is, It's none of your business. Whatever a person chooses to do with their body and what is inside their body is their own business. And so this right to life doesn't really matter for the baby in the womb. It only matters for the mother. And she doesn't just have a right to life, but a right to liberty, to have the freedom to choose whatever she would for whatever is inside of her control. At this argument, I just really struggle with this one, because I think all parenthood involves the sacrifice of individual liberties for the care of another. If I have the right to liberty, the right to an unencumbered life, does that mean if a child gets in my way and drives me crazy, I can beat them, I can shove them, I can mistreat them because they're in the way of my personal liberty to do what I want? I think these arguments around personal liberty ultimately are arguments of individual selfishness. But those are the five major positions people will take on when the right to life kicks in: at conception, at brain function, at viability, at birth, or ultimately, really, who cares? Now, the final thing I want to cover here as we talk about the Christian argument for a right to life for the preborn has to do with understanding the objections that people give on the other side. This would be commonly called a pro-choice argument. And this is where Thaddeus Williams' book, Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth, is so, so good. He has an appendix, actually. This isn't the main subject of his book, but his appendix here, he summarizes the pro-choice argument in an acronym of CHOICE. So CHOICE, to help you remember it. Here's the first argument. The C stands for the coat hanger argument. Here's the way it's commonly stated. If we didn't have Roe v. Wade and legal protections of abortion, women would be getting abortions done with coat hangers in back alleys. Okay, that is a crude argument. What's the reality to that? The reality to that is most stats in the world today say that before access was legalized with Roe v. Wade in 1973, around 200 women died every year in the practice of obtaining an abortion. Now, every death is a tragedy, but to think that women were widespread using coat hangers in back alleys to get abortions that were killing them through infection grossly and wildly overstates the case. 200 died per year, and that's a tragedy. It is also a tragedy to look at the millions of preborn humans who were terminated through abortion in America following that legalization. Here's the reality. 90%+ of abortions happening before Roe v. Wade in some way happened and were condoned, and people were not dying widely because of coat hanger unhealth. Okay, that's the first argument. The second one, H, has to do with hardship. And this one, honestly, this argument is related to children being born with severe disabilities. They say an individual, if we know in the womb, is severely disabled, that the hardship on life, both to the individual and to the family, is devastating and should be a consideration in bringing that person into the world. I get emotional even thinking about this one. Because children with disabilities aren't liabilities. They're people made in God's image. And disability does not necessarily mean unhappiness. We need to be so careful as people to not demean the disabled. They may not have full function in some ways as others do, but lack of full function does not mean a lack of full life. So, the hardship argument. The third argument, one that people make a lot, is related to the letter O. That one stands for overpopulation. There are just too many daggone people in the world, is the way the argument goes. And we're consuming the climate and all that sort of thing. I'm not going to comment on that argument. Incest and rape. Okay, so this one is probably the most poignant emotional argument. They say an individual who's faced the unwanted sexual trauma of incest and rape should not now be subjected to additional unwanted trauma of birthing the child. And for this, we as Christians first need to stop. And before we make any argument, we need to weep with those who weep about the heartbreaking trauma that comes to people who are sexually abused. Unwanted sexual abuse is traumatic. And that should break all our hearts. But on the spectrum of reality, At the highest level estimates we have, those sorts of instances result in around 1%, probably less, of all abortions that are performed. So the incest and rape argument, which is most commonly the one put forward to move people's heartstrings, is far and away the least common reason for an individual getting an abortion. And ultimately, while they have faced incredible trauma, we will not heal incredible trauma by perpetuating and by solving an evil with another evil. Healing can come from a courageous step on the part of that mother to bring good from evil. Okay, C. This one has to do with choosing for my body. And you'll see slogans like, my body, my choice, or no womb, no say, which is basically saying you need to be quiet men and you need to be quiet government. A preborn person isn't something inside your body, so what business do you have talking about it? Well, the problem with I need to make the choice for my body is that the individual inside you as a child is not your body. They're an intimately connected, separate person. They have separate DNA structures. They aren't you. They're their own person. And the other problem with the choosing for my body, my choice, attempts to make that choice seem like something that is heroic for a person. I chose to go get an abortion, but that's not actually the way people relate the experience who have an abortion. If we look at post-abortion stats, 64% of women who had abortion performed said they were pressured into it by others. 78% of them relate profound and long-term guilt. 60% of them would say, this phrase accurately describes what I feel. I feel as if a part of me died. Choosing for my body demeans the level of choice that people are making. And then the last argument under choice. So let's go over them again. C, coat hangers. H, hardship. O, overpopulation. I, incest and rape. C, choice for my body. And E is economic discrimination. Basically, it says this. If we ban the legal practice of abortion, we leave poor women in these economic stresses. And then you add a baby on top of it. And they're all, oh dear, what would they do? And look, again, we should feel concern for people trapped in economically devastating situations. But abortion isn't an economic solution to economic pain. To act as if, well, as long as we don't add a child in there, we're not hurting. No, there's not necessarily a correlation here. Just because a child is costly doesn't mean that they're not valuable. So this is part one. And in part one, here's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to step back and try to give a moral and compelling biblical argument for why the right to life for those who are preborn matters. And as we end this one, I just want to go back to where we started and say to you, in 2018, the number one cause of death worldwide among people made in God's image was the termination of the life of a preborn individual in the womb. 42 million children died in 2018 from abortion. And so as Christians who care about people made in God's image, that means we have to understand that, and we do also have to do something about it. So now part two, if you tune into the podcast next week, that's our topic. What are we supposed to do to work for the rights of the unborn? And how can we work to see them given the mercy, compassion, and justice they deserve, the life they deserve as those made in God's image? So I hope you tune in next time to part two of this on what it looks like to work for the rights of the unborn.